Welcome to the Reader's Roundtable edition of Cattlecast with Jessica Trotter, Mari Garza, and Cheryl Lindemann.
Welcome back to the Reader's Roundtable edition of Cattlecast. I'm Jessica Trotter, and I'm joined by Cheryl Lindemann and Mari Garza. Hey, ladies.
Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
We are your primary selection team here at Cattle. We always take a little time and kind of deciding what we're going to talk about. One of the things, this has just been such a long and strange year. New Year's is around the corner, and it's in sight finally, guys. But again, in looking back on my reading and kind of the giant list of titles I didn't get to, and then we're starting to see the year-end lists, it's just 2020 was really, I mean, it was a really phenomenal publishing year. For all of this that's happened, there are so many great titles out there this year.
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing all the end-of-year lists, you know, the NPR Book Concierge, the New York Times, all the papers and publications, and we had a little discussion.
Well, I love all of those, actually. I like to compare to see, like, did I think that one was good?
Right.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah. Or better yet. Oh, cool. Somebody else agrees with me.
Yes, right?
Isn't that fun?
Especially when it's a pick that, wasn't quite as promoted, that sort of thing.
Which happened a lot this year, too.
Yeah, there was just so much great stuff. And what was really cool to me was the variety across the list. You know, sometimes it's like there's this top 10 and it's everywhere and everybody's saying the same thing to some degree. But I felt like this was the most variety that I've seen on the top.
Across the list, yep.
Yeah, there's just, you know, certain things weren't picked up at all by an organization. And then other books that didn't get quite as much press were picked up in the top. So, yeah, it's been really, really fun to read those and be reminded of a few things that, oh yeah, I really wanted to read that. I feel like every year that's a problem. You know, you never get to what you want to read.
Oh no.
It's just too much. But even more so this year, because we had that laggy period where we couldn't get materials being closed.
Well, and just the whole period of what you could comfortably read.
Yes.
Too. I mean, it's a thing too, which I think we'll come back to at different places today. And, you know, just so people are aware, I mean, there's most of the newspapers have a best of. The Library Journal, I'm participating in something called Library Faves, which is a hashtag on Twitter. And and I'll put the hashtag in the show notes, but it's LibFaves20. And just watching the variety of librarians across the country sharing their picks is... It's such a broad range of titles. You know, there are certain titles that, yes, do stand out and make a lot of the lists. But really, the range is huge this year.
It was Library Journal that said the worst year and the best books. That was, their headline on the article.
Nice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, very much.
Right.
So with all that said, where do you want to start?
I'm going to kick it off just mentioning a couple of my favorite picture books of the year, which I highly recommend both of them for gift giving if you so choose. The first title is I Am Every Good Thing. It's by Derek Barnes. And it's illustrated by Gordon C. James. And if you remember these two, they were behind Crown. That's from 2017. But this is just a beautiful, beautiful book because it celebrates boyhood in the context of, you know, we live in a racist society that has, you know, puts a lot of messages about boys out there, you know, in particular Black boys. And this story is just such a beautiful celebration of all that boys can be. Just that they are full of light and full of energy and power and joy, and that they have so much to offer. So I really, really love this. And one of the reasons why it really stood out to me is because not long after I read this, I don't know if you guys were, saw this video was going around on Facebook. It was a grandpa and his dad that were kind of rapping a song to the ABCs. Like, you know, I could be an AA, I could be an architect, or D, I could be a dentist. It was just so cute. It was beautiful. absolutely loved it. I think that was from a family in, I want to say in Tennessee, but anyway, like just both having read that book and then seen that video, it was just beautiful. I loved it. Then the other book that I also really love, not just because I love the illustrator, is I Talk Like a River. This is by Jordan Scott, and the pictures were by Sydney Smith. And it's just beautifully illustrated about a boy. It's really more of a poem is what it is. But it's about a boy who has a stutter. And it's, you know, he's just fraught with, you know, frustration and feeling stuck and feeling like he cannot express himself. And this poem is just so beautiful about, you know, about this boy, you know, this father who is encouraging him to help him discover his sense of voice and his sense of person. Just how much he is just wanting him to just accept who he is and connect with the world around him. And the river, I mean, if you think of a river, I mean, I can't think of any rivers that are near us that are like super rushing the way this river in this book is depicted. But there's rocks and there's like this rush of sound, and it jags and it goes right and left. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful picture. And Sydney Smith has done wonders with so many different books. He was behind Sidewalk Flowers and just some other books that I've really come to enjoy his work. So I recommend that one. That's just beautiful. Two beautiful picture books.
Lovely.
Yeah, they sound wonderful. I have a few in the similar category, two picture books that I recommend as gifts. And I think these, and it sounds like the two that you just talked about, Madi, have all ages appeal. I mean, so many picture books do. They're
right.
Yes. Food for the soul for all of us. But these two I found really inspirational. And the first one is How to Solve a Problem, The Rise and Falls of a Rock Climbing Champion.
Oh, I love that one. Yes.
Oh, isn't it wonderful? Yeah. And it's written by the author, by the rock climber, Ashima Shiraishi, with really incredible, almost graphic novel style illustrations by Yao Xiao. And Ashima Shiraishi is a boulder climber, a rock climber. She started at a very young age. She started at 6 years old. And this book, it's so cool the way it's written. It's not like, you know, this is my name and this is my life. It's more like dives right into climbing a boulder. And I didn't realize this, but boulders and rocks are called problems in the climbing world. And so it's very metaphorical, of course, then about how she breaks this down into steps. And the best part for me, it makes me think of Being Perfect, that book that I talked about earlier this year, the nonfiction book, because the falls are part of the problem solving process.
Yeah.
So they're not failures and they're not mistakes, right? So it's like, and it's also very, it's so cool. It's like she maps out a process. The falls give her the tip. Like, okay, I need to move, I need to bend. And it's just so metaphorical for anything that you're thinking about. You know, what's this problem and how do we get through it? And how do we learn from failure in quotes, totally taking that idea out, but it's like necessary for solving the problem, right?
Part of the process of, I don't want to say perfecting, but the process of advancing.
Yeah,
and getting better. I like it.
It's just so cool. It's brilliant, really. I'm in love with this book. I feel like it's very cool. Yeah, it's like so inspirational. And the other one was one of those where you're just like, wow, after you read this book. It's called Digging for Words, Jose Alberto Gutierrez and the Library He Built, written by Angela Burke Kunkel and illustrated by Paulo Escobar. And the illustrations are just so magical. They're literally just, you know, these pictures and like butterflies and planets and fish are just popping out of this book. And this is the story. It's a true story. The actual picture book is built on two people named Jose. And one is a little boy. And then one is this real person named Jose Alberto Gutierrez, who who is actually a garbage collector in Bogota, Colombia. And the story is that he took a book from some trash one day. I believe it was Anna Karenina. And he started to build a library in his own personal home. And the other part of the story, it doesn't really give away the book because it's so magical just to tell you this, but the little boy, Jose, is going to school during the week and he just can't wait to get to the weekend when he can visit this library. And so at the end, there's even a photograph of the library in Jose Alberto Gutierrez's home. And this is a, you know, functioning library that he's built with cast-offs that he's found on his route. So it's just incredibly inspiring, very hopeful, and just a story about somebody, you know, taking taking the situation of something that he found and making just something that changes lives out of it. So, yeah, just absolutely wonderful picture book. I highly recommend for all ages and for those who love books and libraries and that sort of thing. So just an excellent read. And then Jessica, you had one that you didn't have a picture book, but I think it was a teen book you had mentioned.
Or I can, well, actually, let me go this way instead. I'm going to talk about my, it's a collection of comics, or it's in our graphic novel collection. It kind of could go either way. It's I Will Judge You by Your Bookshelf by Grant Snyder.
I've heard of that title, yes.
Oh, it's lovely. This is for any reader and writer or writer in, you know, this is a lovely gift book for any reader of any kind. Grant Snyder is a New York Times illustrator. He had an earlier collection that I really loved that was about ideas, how people come up with ideas, how to nurture ideas. And this just jumps, goes forward with that because it's looking at ideas about how one judges somebody else's bookshelf, you know, how they have it laid out, what are the titles on it. But it's in this latest collection, it's just an exploration of the joys and frustrations of reading and writing, genre, proofreading. There's even a thing, it includes a strip on reading to children. It has a couple of different strips on libraries. And then there's even one on gift books. Yep.
Yeah. Is there one on looking at people's bookshelves when they're on a Zoom meeting?
I think it got picked up before this.
It'll be in the next one.
I am fairly certain it should be an added one, definitely.
That is so funny because whenever you say, especially the newscasters.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
What's behind there?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Oh,
I want to know what they read.
And it becomes a really big thing. I was on Twitter one day and like the romance genre, the romance landia, the romance Twitter section of the world was just going to town identifying every title behind somebody. I might have been Stacey Abrams, actually.
Oh, wow.
She reads so voraciously and so widely, and they were trying to pick out the romance titles, I think. So it is, and I'm sure if he hasn't done it yet, that's on the list of things he would do.
Yeah, that could be a whole book.
That kind of book. So, and it was just, there's a lot of funny, there's a lot of, you know, it's the highs and lows that, you know, that you go through when you're reading a book, including that, you know, the end where you, you know, it's over and you can't have that first feeling again. So it's just, and it's an all ages, you know, of course adults are going to get more out of it, but it is a really neat book.
Come on. Sounds great.
Who wants to go next? Or where do you want to go next?
Well, I'll bring up another picture book if you don't mind. It's more of a nonfiction book, but it is a picture book all the same.
Sure.
It's called Free for Me, For You and Me, What Our First Amendment Means, or it could be What Our First Amendment Means and then Free for You and Me. Uh-huh. It's by Christy Mahaly, illustrated by Manu Montoya. And it's actually a book about the First Amendment. It's really a very neat book described for children about, you know, the freedoms that we take for granted, like freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press. And I have to say that it wasn't really on anybody's list. It's on Maddie's list.
And that's a list. It's all
good. It stood out to me for how detailed it decided to be about that one amendment, which of course has many different parts to it. And it presented it for, you know, it presented conversation about this for children. But what does this really mean? And, you know, this is so important in our country in particular, you know, as well as other places. But, you know, forming a protest and how to do it peaceably and how to tell our leaders when we disagree with something and, you know, they represent us. And just really, really a neat book. And the woman who wrote it is a lawyer. So I could appreciate how she went about, you know, mapping out the book, you know, talking about how everyone is able to express themselves. And then she also got into like a little bit of the history of, you know, how like there have been times in our country's history when we have not honored that freedom and people have gone to jail or to prison for expressing, you know, disagreement with the president or something. And like, wait, what about the First Amendment? So I really enjoyed this mm-hmm. picture book. And I think that there will be more coming out. Related cool. to really
good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sounds like a really good approach to a difficult,
yes.
difficult topic. Yeah. It's so hard to break some of these books are really helpful when you can break these topics down for kids.
Yes. Yes.
Answer questions. Cause it just seems, especially right now, I feel like with just the changes in the media, just the way that we all consume media in a different way, I feel like kids are even closer, even though there's not as much nightly news watching, probably they're closer to these topics, but they don't understand them. You know right. what I'm saying? So the swirling right. around, it kind of creates yeah. this sort of generalized anxiety, like what is this, you know? Yeah. So that's really yeah. cool.
On that note, do you mind if I jump in and do that other one now too? Ooh. Because I think that Go actually follows it. In yeah. right on that, because one of the other things I read on walking trips over the summer and I yeah. has really stuck with me is Stamped. It's by Jason Reynolds, but it's really kind of a remix of Ibram Kendi's book Stamped from the Beginning. Uh-huh. But it is written for teen readers. And it's a really timely, hip look at the history of racism. This is sort of Jason's words, but it doesn't feel like homework. And I totally agree. It gives you a really nice background on the history of racism, but in a way and in chunks that are understandable. I would suggest this for any adult who wants the more broken down version than Kendi's very scholarly book.
I totally agree. Did you say you listened to it, Jessica?
Yes, I did.
I did too. Oh,
and
man.
Jason is a yeah. wonderful reader. Yeah. And it's just that perfect, I can totally, it's the voice, he has a voice that teens will listen to. He just does. Yes. Yeah. Kids and teens will listen to. You know, it's funny for such a deeply disturbing topic in a lot of ways. It's self-deprecating in a sense. It's really well, I think of this as something, he speaks like my teenage nephews in a sense.
Yeah.
And they would understand it. And I understand them, so I understand him. but it's one of those things. It's just a neat way of telling the history.
Yes.
Yeah. And I would highly suggest it. And I would highly suggest the audio, of course. Yes. But just the book in general is really well done. And again, you know, if you're ready to take on the world, go for Stamped from the Beginning by Kendi. But you know, if you need to kind of come at this in a different way, this is a great way of listening to it.
Yeah. I also think it's a great listen for families. Like,
yes, I would agree. Definitely.
Just to be able to talk about our societal issues and yeah. ills and, you know, why we look at things the way we do.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Well, I have two books that I think follow well with
yes, they do.
With that one,
yes.
Jessica. Yeah. These two are just such important books. And I was so excited when I heard about them and had to wait a while to get them. And I've got one actually last week, but it came. So I'm so glad I was able to yep. talk about it this year.
I have seen both of them on some of the end of year lists, especially the first one. It's African American poetry, 250 years of struggle and song, edited by Kevin Young. This is a Library of America anthology. And it joins the ranks of other African American poetry anthologies, but really not enough. Not enough. And this one is very very comprehensive. It starts in 1770. First poem is Phyllis Wheatley. And the final poem in the anthology is Jamila Woods. And it goes all through all a number of poetry movements, from the Harlem Renaissance to the Black Arts Movement, the Chicago Renaissance, the Umbra Group, Cave Canem, and the Dark Noise Collective more recently. And has a really nice section on more recent poetry that I really dove into. One of the poems that really stood out for me is from a poet who also has a book named Homie. That's on some of the end of lists. It's Denez Smith. Wow. the poem in this collection that was selected is Dinosaurs in the Hood. It's an incredible poem. Camille Rankin, whose book Citizen is on a number of the bestseller best book lists for the year. She's in here. Morgan Parker, Shane McRae, Jericho Brown, Saeed Jones. We talked about Saeed Jones before, and Jericho Brown on the podcast. Yeah. I discovered poets more than I can even mention here. I could do the whole podcast on this book. But Clint Smith, Nicole Seeley from the contemporary section on here. So this is it's just a gorgeous book. It's a weighty book. It's beautiful. Be a beautiful gift. And it's a classic, and it will be a classic going forward.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, I think his name is Joshua Bennett.
I believe he is in here. And there's another lovely thing about this book is that it has a really excellent index. It's really usable and a great biographical notes profile of each poet. So it's just really well done. It's easy to use. It's well done. And it's one of those you just get lost in, and then you're looking people up. And of course, I'm checking the collection. Do we have this poet? I'm adding things.
So that book is in the shorts TBR, right? Like right next to where I sit in the living room.
Oh, awesome.
it's getting close.
It's fantastic. It really is. So I love these books because it's perfect for this year too. You can dip in and out. And then they're just, they're like a launch pad for discovering more about a certain poet.
So. Right.
Right.
On that same theme, going in a different direction, is Marcus Samuelson's The Rise, Black Cooks in the Soul of American Food. This is the book I actually received last week. I was so excited when I heard this book was coming out, and I waited and waited, and here it is. And it did not disappoint. It's gorgeous, by the way. It's gorgeous photographs. Beautifully designed, though. Also, just the layout and design is just stunning on this book. And it is so rich. It's not just a cookbook at all. It is just absolutely so rich. And what he does in this book, and Marcus Samuelson is a restaurateur, he's had several TV shows, but he's an activist. And what this book does is it takes profiles of Black chefs, activists, writers, and has a photograph and then a little kind of like an interview profile with individuals. And then Marcus Samuelson and a team of a few other chefs have created a recipe sort of in honor of that person. And they pull from this huge variety of African-American cuisine. I mean, there's soul food, Caribbean food. Mm-hmm. It's so diverse. I learned so much from this book. And he talks about that. He talks about how there's this tradition in America of learning about Italian food, loving Italian food, but not as much about learning about food from the Caribbean, food from Africa, food from African-American food from different parts of the country. And there's a lot of stereotyping about what that means.
Exactly.
So I learned so much from this, and it's really just a fantastic book. Another piece of it that I really liked, again, is the resource section. The bibliography of cookbooks is huge. And again, it's a nice launch pad for further exploration. And he also gives credit to what came before him.
And he talks about this idea of the rise, and he says it stands on three pillars. And to quote him, he says, the first is the authorship of our food and our rituals. The second is the memory of history, where we started and where we've gone. And the third is the aspiration for the future. It's a really sort of a powerful, it's really a powerful book. It's not just about food, you know, it's about a reclamation to some degree of, and saying this is American cuisine and we need to be talking about it more. We need to learn about it more and pay it the respect that it's due. So a couple people that were featured in here are Tony Tipton Martin, who is the author of Jubilee from last year.
Okay.
And And then Kwame Onuachi, who wrote Notes from a Young Black Chef, is in here. But that just scratches the surface.
Mm-hmm.
One last thing. I don't want to talk the whole show about this one book. But it is, he was one of the people who turned his, he was starting one of his restaurants in
one of the Red Roosters. Yep.
Yeah. And then in February, late February. And then, of course, the pandemic hit. And so he transitioned the kitchen into one of the World Central Kitchen Project restaurants. So they, restaurant isn't the right word, but they basically fed people out of the kitchen in the local community. And he was, I think a number of his restaurants did that. So that's how he starts out the introduction, is talking about that experience. So just a wonderful book. Excellent for a gift for this year.
Yeah, definitely. Let me jump in with a couple of, I've got a couple of Michigan books. Actually, I have three, but I'll do two to begin with. That I really enjoyed this year. One of them is Black Bottom Saints by Alice Randall. This is, so before Motown, there was the Black Bottom neighborhood in Detroit.
Yes.
And in its heyday, it was a center for American Black culture. And in Black Bottom Saints, Alice Randall introduces the reader to a who's who of notable people, residents and visitors to Black Bottom, free sort of teens to the 40s-ish sort. I mean, it goes farther up, but it's that's sort of the where it's really looking. And it's laid out as a book of saints. So there are 52 individuals featured. There's a write-up about each of them. They're real people. This is a book that made me kind of, I'm reading about this. It's, again, as Cheryl was kind of noting, it's one of those things. Again, it's 52 separate people, so you can pick it up and put it down and read the people. But I did because I wanted to know more about them. So I'm like, you know, I'll read about this person and like, I had no idea that they came to Detroit or that they lived in Detroit or she was married to that superstar or it was a very weird, you know, there are actresses that I'd heard of kind of in name and didn't realize that they were married to a football player who I've only heard of kind of, you know, you hear their names, but you don't kind of put, you just don't know the history. So I spent so much time going and looking up individuals. And there's so many that I didn't know at all. And they're just really interesting individuals to go look up. Then there's the few that the ones that I did know, but I'm looking and thinking, I had no idea some of the stories that came through. And the narrator of the story is also a real person. It was somebody who had a school for kids and learning to dance, did shows featuring pageants, basically featuring the African-American community. And he was also a DJ and he was essentially kind of a gossip columnist in the newspapers as well about the entertainment community in Detroit at that time. It's just a really neat book and neat stories. And again, it's just one where you're kind of looking around and thinking, I want to know more about that. I mean, I know every person.
Yeah.
Because if there is a point where you're trying to think, is this really real? Yeah, they're all really real people.
So were there any photographs in the book?
No, okay. There weren't. But you could find them fairly easily.
I have long been very curious about this history of Detroit, because I worked down at the Detroit Medical Center and Wayne State University. And that is, you know, what was kind of wiped out to begin building that whole complex.
And it's,
so I've heard about it for a long time. Like, I would love to know more about what was going on and what
this is a really interesting starter for thinking about. It's pretty heavy on the entertainment part of it, but I mean, it talks about a little bit of everything. I mean, it's really about the community. It was just a neat book. So I would highly recommend it. It has made a couple of the year end lists. It's one of those ones people should know about.
Yeah.
And another one, I got to mention this one because I loved this author's first book. Wicked Sister came out this year by Karen Dion. And if you're not familiar, she wrote The Marsh King's Daughter a couple years ago, which was a Michigan Notable title. I mean, it was an international bestseller. And
I was sucked in by that book like you wouldn't believe.
Yes.
Because I love the UP, but anyway.
Yes. And The Wicked Sister is also set in the UP. And it's, much in similar ways to The Marsh King's Daughter. It's a kind of a character in the story as well. And also in similar ways to The Marsh King's Daughter, there's this. In The Marsh King's Daughter, they kind of played with the back and forth of the fairy tale part of the story. Mm-hmm. The Wicked Sister takes a different twist on it, but that still there is still a fairy tale element to it. It is of course, a thriller. It starts with a woman confronted with proof that she did not, in fact, murder her parents. For 15 years, she thought she had. It's not something she was accused of. The deaths were ruled a murder-suicide, as in her father killed her mother. But she had this recurring memory, she was sure, that she was standing over them with a gun. And she really thought, and she's been punishing herself. She's been institutionalized for 15 years. And on her 18th birthday, she put herself back in. And this comes up, and she's basically agreed to do an interview with somebody, and they have the police report, and she opens up the police report, not expecting to find anything. But she looks at this and she's like, wait a minute. They literally prove that she can't have done it.
Wow.
And she needs to know why her remaining family members have let her believe this.
Wow.
So she checks herself out, which might be the least believable part of it. But still, this is a really good, it's a great story. But she goes home and tries to figure out what's going on and what happened. And it's a solid thriller. It really is.
Wow.
And they're outdoors people, and they're environmental scientists. Her parents were, one studied bears and one studied cats, I want to say. But they, and that's what she grew up in, and being outdoors and doing that kind of work. So it's, and of course, she has a sister and an aunt, and there are people that she needs answers from.
Yeah. So. Is Karen Dion a Michigan author then? Does she live in Michigan?
Okay. Yeah, she used to live in the UP. I'm not actually sure where she lives now.
Okay. Well, I thought she lived in Livonia, but it could be.
Yeah, wrong. I think she does now. I think she's downstate now, but she spent, I think her early, when she was interviewed, I think I interviewed her for Marsh King's Daughter, and she, I want to say maybe one of her first children, when she was raising a child kind of in the middle of nowhere in the UP. And that's sort of what's stuck with her in her writing.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah. UP is like a character in the book.
It is. Yeah. It is. I mean, it really, and it's a great character in the book.
Interesting.
It and its wildlife are a great character in this book. So what else have you got?
Well, I have a couple of fiction books for kids that I really want to recommend. Both of them are just great for gift giving, I think. The first one is called Show Me a Sign. It's by Anne Claire Lizotte. And this is a historical fiction book. I'm kind of middle grade. Does the reviews say ages 8 to 14? I don't know if 8, maybe on the young side, but you never know. A really good reader would probably get a lot out of it. This is a gorgeous, gorgeous story because it's something I haven't read either ever or for a long time. It's about a girl who is deaf, and it's set in the 1800s on Martha's Vineyard. And okay. This is about a girl who lives on the island, where a lot of the people are deaf on the island. And it's just like a hereditary trait that has been passed down from the times of when they were in England. It sort of followed them there. So Mary, 11, and she's deaf. I think her father's deaf. Her mother is not. And she has a brother who's had a tragedy in the family. He was not deaf. But it's this really, it's a story that's kind of like at least halfway, if not more, told in sign language. It's so neat. It is so neat to read about how she expresses herself and how the community communicates with each other, because many people in the community are deaf. And anyway, it's a story about a scientist who comes to the island and wants to study the people and try to understand why so many people are deaf. And there are definitely elements of our lesser sides of our nature. I mean, there's the struggle that is going on with the Wampanoag people at the time because of, you know, land disputes and trying to, I guess, stake a claim on property that may or may not be theirs. But also the scientist, I mean, this is the big part of the book, is he is doing not good things in the name of science. And anyway, I just really, really enjoyed reading it. In some ways, I don't know if you guys remember that movie. I think it was called Children of a Lesser God. Mm-hmm. I remember just being mesmerized by that movie. That was also about a deaf woman and a hearing man. But this was definitely one of my favorites of the year. The other title I have is Skunk and Badger. It's by Amy Timberlake, and it's got pictures by John Pleasant. Really, really adorable book. And I have to say, it spoke to me very personally because it's basically about a badger and a skunk who somehow end up living together. And Badger is definitely not expecting Skunk to move in, but he does. And it's this very interesting story about someone who lives alone, and all of a sudden he has a roommate, and this little person or little skunk is like, you know, interrupting him all the time and doing things the way he wants to in the kitchen, and just, it is so funny. I highly recommend this as an intermediate reader, like, you know, maybe grade 2 to 4-ish. It is so cute. I believe it's going to be a series. I think there will be more copies or more stories added. But it's just a beautiful story about how two creatures learn to get along and learn to appreciate one another. And maybe Badger experiences a little less loneliness. So and the other thing I want to mention is that Badger is a rock collector or a rock, I don't know what you would call it, a rock scientist. He does very important work studying rocks.
Of course he does. Yes.
Appealed to me because I love looking at Michigan rocks. And,
yes.
It is just so funny. It is so adorable. I highly recommend this as a gift for
the rock VIP.
Yeah. Yep.
Awesome. That's really fun. In the cover, it looks like a modern classic. That John Classen, you know, the way that cover looks, it's almost like owl and or Frog and Toad or something. It just has this.
I actually confused it with a different book. I thought I had already read it, and I'm like, why are people talking about this book? That's been out for a long time. And then I like, oh no, that's not the same book.
Yeah, it has a sort of like really vintage look to it. Very, very cool.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have another one or two, Cheryl?
You know, I actually, I'm going to save one of the ones that I was going to talk about today for next time.
The first one is, I said I had three Michigan books, and this one's vaguely Michigan. It's called Heartland Habitats, 265 Midwest Nature Walks by Mary Blaxma. It's set out time-wise. She's going through a year. It would be a lovely gift book for nature lovers, or maybe those who've kind of rediscovered nature in response to the pandemic, you know, or getting out more, or getting doing their walks. And it's sort of, it's kind of a lovely guide of what to look for on your walks, or even in your own backyard. You know, she goes from birds to fungi to, you know, the different kinds of animals that you might see. It's a well drawn. I mean, it's really pretty. So it's just one that I think people should know about.
Yeah. We had that on Hoopla too, I saw.
Yes, and actually that's how I got it first.
Yeah, because there was quite the list. That was one of those high demand, you know, titles. Yeah, that's cool.
Mm-hmm. And that's sort of as I'm going through it and thinking, you know, it's just kind of a pretty book. And if you're just kind of figuring out what to look for in the Midwest, it's a nice book that way.
Yeah, it's quiet. And it might be inspiring for young people too, to think about maybe doing something like that themselves.
Yes. Yep.
Which is kind of cool and meditative.
Yeah. Yes. And then my last book, I really feel like everybody should know about, and it goes to that whole, the things that we couldn't bring ourselves to read, they'll come around a time when you can.
Yeah.
I finished Pull of the Stars this week by Emma Donahue. Mm-hmm. It is a book that I really wanted to avoid early on in the pandemic. It is about the 1918 pandemic. Mm-hmm. And it is a relatively brief novel looking at 3 days. I mean, it feels relatively brief. It's actually not that short. It follows 3 days in the pandemic following a maternity ward nurse. She works specifically with women who have the flu. This is in Dublin. It's also at this point, you know, it's the wake of World War I, and it's about a year into the Irish War of Independence as well. Everything's going on and wrong. And then in Julia's tiny ward of sick expectant mothers, everything's going to change one day when she is introduced to Dr. Lynn, who is they're desperate for doctors at this point. Everybody's down with the flu. And this is actually a woman who is part of the opposition, but because she is a doctor, they're letting her do her work to some degree, even though she's a relatively high-placed member of Sinn Féin. And then a young woman named Bridie Sweeney is introduced as a volunteer to the hospital. Again, they're just so desperate for people. And this is a woman that's been boarding. So she was an orphan. She was boarding with the local convent. It's really beautiful. It's really beautiful writing. It's a beautiful story. It's also really heartbreaking. Mm. And it's easily one of the best books I've read all year. So if you are prepared to kind of lean into the pandemic a little bit, pandemic stories a little bit, this is a really, really lovely story.
Wow.
So yeah, a little bit of a downer, but it was a really good book. I really think people should give it a try. But again, there's just so many books, so many books, and so many that I wasn't ready to read. That one just seemed to come round. It was okay. Yeah. But I've got so many I never got to and want to get back to. And I think we're kind of coming around to the end. Is there kind of a last, what are you reading now, or what are you hoping to get back to?
Well, let's just say hoping to start.
There you go.
Everything Sad is Untrue by Daniel
about that one.
Nayeri. It's also a kid's fiction book. It's about a child from Iran who settles here in the U.S., and I have checked it out twice and not been able to read it either time, but right now it's on my coffee table, and I hope to, to start it and maybe have it done soon. So that's on my list.
How about you, Cheryl?
I had so many I couldn't get to, just like we all did. I have finally started Cast, the Oregon's
origins of our discontents. It's on almost every one of the best of lists.
Yes.
I'm sure our listeners have heard of it. Isabel Wilkerson, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize winning The Warmth of Other Suns. And I've started it, and it just pulls you right in. It's so incredibly, her writing style is just so, it just pulls the reader in. That's all I can say to begin that one. Mm-hmm. And then one that I didn't get to read, and like Madi have checked out over and over and over again. This I have seen on a few lists, but this is one of those sort of sleeper books that maybe isn't the top 10 on every list. But it's by a science journalist named Sonia Shaw. And it's called The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. And briefly, it's about migration, human and animal. And the premise is that migration is part of human and animal history. It is who we are. We are migrants. We have migrated, and it's extremely natural and normal and perhaps not seen that way in our common or world right now with the borders that we have. So sort of a science and a social science book. And she also wrote a book called Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond. But this one really tackles migration. So I will read this book, and we'll talk about it at a future podcast, but it's just not happening quite yet. So,
and mine's actually The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue, which is being pretty much promoted as V.E. Schwab's masterwork. And I've started it so many times, and it's lovely writing, and for some reason I've had to put it down. It's about a young woman, essentially, who makes a deal with the devil to, it ends up she's going to live forever or for at least a very long time. But the trade-off is that nobody remembers her after. And it looks at but it's also a meditation on creation and creatives and how do you live with that kind of trade-off? The devil character expects this not to last very long, but the story opens up in modern days pretty much. I can't remember where the story kind of backs up to early on, but she must be going on 400 or 500 years old in the modern day part of the story. And to go all that way with nobody remembering who you are is just, So it's just one of those things that it's gotten such phenomenal reviews across the board that I just have to read it. And I already know that the writing is beautiful, and I just need to sit down and figure out a way to focus, because that's my running problem still. But again, so many books. All right. I think we need to wrap it up. Thank you for listening, and we will be back next month. Thanks for talking with me, ladies.
Thank you. Welcome. Happy to love
these chances.
Yes, I agree.
Okay. All right. See you next time.
Bye.
Hi, I'm a professional magician here to tell you about the most magical places I know. Your Capital Area District Library. Download, stream, or check out great entertainment for the whole family. Your favorite movies, TV series, music albums, and more are just a click away. A CATL membership can save you hundreds of dollars a year in free services. Get yours today and let the magic begin right here.